You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 23rd of April 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Dominic Reynolds, and Phil Hahn.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll be heading to Hong Kong to see what stories are setting the news agenda in Asia. Our bureau chief there, Aisha Spears, joins us now on the line. Aisha, what's grabbed your attention?
We're going to do an update on the Sichuan earthquake, talk about air quality in Beijing, and also a very nice man in Hong Kong.
Plus, Venezuela has been thrown into crisis after an election result no one expected. We'll find out what challenges are ahead for Nicolas Maduro.
This year, it's once again going to have one of the highest inflation rates in the world. Economic growth is falling as government spending is slowing. There are actually a lot of shortages of products at the moment. People's purchasing power is going down a lot. So that's probably the main problem that Nicolas Maduro has on his plate.
And in the new issue of Monocle, we head to Beirut to find out about a near-centuries-old publishing business that's reinventing itself.
Also in our preview of the new edition of Section D, Hermès Maison unveils their new collection.
Here with this collection, every object answers the needs for day-to-day life and brings something else. So you have objects that will accompany the day-to-day life in the home.
All that, plus we'll play some great music as well. That's all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
So, all that in the next 58 minutes on today's show, but we will start, as ever, with the news. Here's Barney Burnham.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. The French embassy in Tripoli has been hit by a suspected car bombing. Two guards were injured in what's the first such attack on the Libyan capital since the war which toppled Colonel Gaddafi in 2011. An embassy official said the blast had caused considerable damage. The surviving suspect in the Boston Marathon bombing has been formally charged with conspiring to use weapons of mass destruction in the attack in which three people were killed. Jokhar Tsarnaev was charged in a special court hearing at his hospital bedside. He remains badly injured and under armed guard. If convicted, he could face the death penalty. At the White House, spokesman Jay Carney said Tsarnaev will not be tried as an enemy combatant, but will be prosecuted through the normal court system.
Effective use of the criminal justice system has resulted in the interrogation, conviction, and detention of both U.S. citizens and non-citizens for acts of terrorism committed inside the United States and around the world. The system has repeatedly proven that it can successfully handle the threat that we continue to face.
Boston's Islamic Society has confirmed that the other bombing suspect, Tsarnaev's older brother Tamerlan, twice disrupted sermons to challenge views expressed by preachers who were leading services at a local mosque. But a statement by the society said neither brother had ever expressed any hint of violent sentiments or behavior. If they had, the society says it would have immediately contacted the FBI. Two men will appear in court today charged with plotting a major terrorist attack in Canada. They're accused of planning to bomb passenger trains linking Toronto with New York City. Canadian authorities have described it as an Al-Qaeda-inspired plot, and they claim the pair had support from Iran. Assistant Commissioner James Malicia of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police.
Had this plot been carried out, it would have resulted in innocent people being killed or seriously injured. At all times during the investigation, initiated in August 2012, our primary focus was the safety and protection of the public.
The U.S. Secretary of State has said the vast majority of Muslims around the world oppose violence. John Kerry has called for a continued dialogue with moderate groups. He says it's the only way to stop extremists dominating debate.
We have to speak to moderate Islam and find ways to get moderate Islam to fight and stand up for the real basis of their religion, rather than allowing it to be hijacked by people who completely misinterpret and misapply it.
Scientists in the UK say they've created a strain of bacteria which can produce fuel. A team of researchers at Exeter University genetically modified E. coli bacteria to convert sugar into an oil that's almost identical to conventional diesel. They say that if the process could be scaled up, the synthetic fuel could be a viable alternative to the fossil fuel. The study is published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
So fuel out of bacteria. Extraordinary.
Even E. coli has its uses.
Well, my co-host, Phil, was suffering in sort of ways too vivid to explain over the radio this weekend from a bacteria.
I'm so, just getting over a stomach virus, and I think I
So we
would,
could put you in you, a car in a car tank, and it could go.
I think I could do a bit more than a car tank. I think I could maybe supply enough energy for a small town.
Amazing.
Judging by what happened over the weekend.
Based on the sheer amount of
You're creating images which I'd rather not envisage.
I know. It's radio. Painting pictures here on Monocle 24. Pictures you don't want to see.
Well, thanks very much, Barney. Barney will be back in about 24 minutes with another check of the news headlines. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24.
It's 10:06 in Istanbul, 8:06 a.m. here in London. That makes it 15:06 in Hong Kong.
And that's where we're heading now as we get the show underway with our daily agenda, the three stories you need to know for the next 24 hours. And joining us on the line from our Hong Kong bureau is Monocle's bureau chief there, Aisha Spears. Hello, Aisha. How are you?
I'm better than you, Phil, clearly. It sounds like you had a pretty dodgy weekend.
I'm on the up, though, so it's all okay. But some news out of China regarding that horrendous earthquake over the weekend.
Indeed. So, of course, the world's been covering this, and Hong Kong is looking quite keenly as to what's going on. The People's Liberation Army has started making airdrops of relief supplies to the two worst counties affected in Sichuan province. They're saying that 192 people have been killed and nearly 12,000 are injured. This is clearly quite a test of Beijing at the moment. I think a lot of people are wondering how they're going to respond. They've done better than what happened in 2008 with the big earthquake there, and then in 2011 with the high-speed rail crash. Premier Li Keqiang has visited the site within the first 24 hours, which is a good thing, but they are refusing any foreign help. Beijing are refusing foreign help. So instead, they're looking after their own. They're dropping lots of food. They're setting up mobile phone charging units. There's obviously medical supplies going in. So it's a kind of watch this space at the moment.
And at the same time, as soon as reports come out suggesting that there are areas that are in need of greater help, the sort of media war continues. We lack drugs, said a director of a hospital I read in one particular province. Is there a sense that the sort of battle to contain the story or to show the world the right story is going on?
Definitely. Well, I mean, clearly Li Keqiang going there is a big press trip, a big photo opportunity for everyone who's covering the story. In Hong Kong, people are quite sceptical as to where the money that they're said to donate is going to go. So the government has pledged 100 million Hong Kong dollars of public funds, which is about 10 million euros. The council will decide upon that tomorrow if that's actually going to happen. But a lot of locals are saying that because of the corruption, the money is not actually going to go to the earthquake victims, and that they'd rather hold back on sending that money. And the concern here, this is what Emily Lau, who's the head of the Democratic Party and the Civic Party, has said, is that the concern is it's not that the mainland lack money, they actually just lack a system of getting the money to where it needs to go.
A lot of Hong Kong residents opposing that donation, but the chief executive defending it, saying it was based on love, care, and support for compatriots. There must be, though, some asking the question, is this really the right time to make a case or an argument against the corruption that might be happening in China? Isn't there a better time to make that argument as opposed to now?
Indeed. I mean, it's such an interesting time at the moment with Hong Kong. There's been so much talk about their upcoming election and who will represent them to Beijing. I think it all probably ties into that. But in 2008, the government here gave 10 billion Hong Kong dollars, which is considerably more than what they're offering this time. Obviously, it's a smaller scale disaster, but perhaps that's also a sign of the times that the money then did not go where they thought it would go.
Is there any surprise that the problems with corruption are being expressed in this way, and that we're essentially having people apparently showing a sort of lack of sympathy in that they want to sort of conduct the sort of financial help this way?
I guess it's not a lack of sympathy. It more is a case of they don't think it's a practical option. I think that, you know, they understand that there's money in Beijing who can, and they can do their own work and they don't need Hong Kong's financial aid. And rather than sending financial aid, there should be some way of fixing the structure. I think there's a lot of sympathy, but also it's a practical approach of the money probably won't go where it needs to go.
And has there been a big movement from NGOs like UNICEF, the Salvation Army, the Red Cross, at helping out at this crisis?
Indeed. So all of those people have been sending money to you. I think that amounts to about 10 million Hong Kong dollars as well. And then 100 million Hong Kong dollars has also been donated by Macau. So money is going from this region, but there is a little bit of discussion, and we'll know more tomorrow as to where those public funds that have been assigned by the government will go or not.
Aisha, let's talk about air quality. I believe that you've been noticing some differences yourself. Tell us.
I have. Well, compared to New York, which you would never think is the most kind of refreshing sea breeze, Hong Kong is pretty tough. You know, you do notice that the air quality here is poor. But my colleagues have told me that Beijing is even worse. And indeed, it does seem to be a lot worse. The level of pollutants there are apparently 40 times the recommended exposure limit. And it's getting to the point where the city is worrying a little bit about a brain drain of both locals and expats who will leave the city because the air quality is so bad. It's predicted that it will worsen by about 70% before 2025, and a lot of people refuse to relocate there or want to leave there because their children are at danger.
And we were covering this a bit earlier on Monocle 24, earlier this year, when Beijing was experiencing that record high levels of pollutants in the air. Some 700,000 people are estimated to die each year in China from air pollution. Is there a growing sense that this problem is going to be tackled? Is there a growing environmental movement in China from residents there?
Well, certainly there is in Hong Kong, and I think China, it's probably a lot harder for that to get off the ground. But in Hong Kong, a lot of people are trying to work out how they can prevent the air pollution that we find here. A lot of it, they say, gets blown in from China, but some people here say it's actually created here because the Pearl River Delta is obviously a big problem in that. But if they're starting to lose money in Beijing because people won't move there, I'm sure that it's a great impetus to crack down on the smog issue.
And also the sort of huge financial implications of trying to run a functioning city if the air quality gets much worse. I was reading reports of certain schools are considering building sort of giant domes under which sort of competitive sport can take place, so the competitors can breathe sort of healthily while they're playing. I mean, taking that as a touchstone, all sorts of hugely expensive and sort of financially sort of risky things would have to be put into place, wouldn't they?
Indeed. I mean, right from the private level, people are spending equivalent of thousands of US dollars on air filtration units for their own homes. So there's a Swiss company that's doing very well in Beijing who makes these air filtration units, and ranging, as you say, all the way to the big schools, predominantly international schools like Dulwich College, who have a Beijing outpost. They have built this very odd, futuristic kind of Eden project looking bubble over their sports ground, which contains hospital quality filtration in order for kids to be able to play out there. So from people wearing masks in the street to kids having to have kind of quite high-tech equipment at home to prevent it, all the way to schools being covered in domes, it's quite severe, and severe enough that the US government actually offers diplomats who are posted to Beijing an extra 15% extra on their salaries. And that comes a lot from the fact that they don't want to go there, they don't want to bring their families there because of the pollution.
But it does really leave the Chinese government in a difficult position, doesn't it? Because it can't necessarily cut down its industrial output because it needs that economic growth so desperately to grow and expand. So it leaves them in a difficult position as to how they manage this pollution problem while still continuing economic growth.
Indeed, but if their economic growth is stunted by the fact that no one wants to live there or do business there, then, you know, it's not nowhere near as bad as in Shanghai or other secondary cities which are coming up in China. If they see such a huge kind of mass exodus of people because they don't want to breathe there, they'll have to do something about it. Or are we looking at a future city where the whole city is going to be covered in these weird bubbles? Who knows?
Aisha, tell us about the kindest man in Hong Kong.
I love this guy, the kindest man in Hong Kong, who's a big story in the South China Morning Post today. It's just a guy who managed to find 74,000 Hong Kong dollars in cash in a bag, in a plastic bag on a bus, actually just on the side of a bus stop, which amounts to just about 7,000 euros. And he turned it into the police. It turned out that a guy who'd been riding that bus home, who worked in a bar, it was the cash takings for the bar that he was taking, he'd left this plastic bag on the bus, and the man who found it handed it into the police, and it was eventually given to its rightful owner. And it does remind you that Hong Kong is incredibly, incredibly safe. I mean, the crime levels here are so low. There were only 27 murders for the whole of last year. There was not a single robbery with a firearm. So a very, very different scene from what I hear often when I was in New York. And people often say that you could leave your phone in a taxi, it will come back to you. You can leave your wallet on a table in a restaurant, no one's going to touch it.
So the kindness of strangers definitely rings true in Hong Kong there. Thanks very much. That was Monocle's Hong Kong Bureau Chief, Aisha Spears.
Now, coming up, we're heading to Venezuela to find out what is happening with Nicolas Maduro's situation there. And we'll also find out what's going to happen for that country thrown into crisis.
Each Sunday on Monocle 24, we like to take stock.
The wonder of history for the journalist is you can delve into this immense booty of information.
I don't even know what to think about that.
Take the global pulse.
I was at a bunga bunga party the other day.
And?
I wasn't at all. I just wanted to start a show like that. We're 187 shows down. How's your week been?
I'm feeling 187, actually.
And occasionally take things down a notch, too.
I had a pair of plum suede loafers with gold snaffles. The guy stopped his car and leant out of the window and said it was people like me who were bringing this country to its knees.
To end the week with the best chat.
We know that he had them and we know that he'd used them before.
Because we still had the receipts.
Well, there's that.
Some great music.
Do you know, I never thought that I might need to have a question about death metal, but I'm warming up.
And some good fun to set up Sunday and warm the week ahead. The Monocle Weekly. Your week starts here.
Each week on The Curator, one of our Monocle editors rounds up the very best of the week just gone on Monocle 24.
You can be European, meaning reliable, responsible, you believe in democracy and environmental protection and, you know, equal justice. These are all Islamic values too.
From hard-hitting political interviews to live music sessions, from food and film to retail and travel, we'll handpick the best of the week's shows for an hour of essential listening.
It's not like New York, because New York, it's like you can walk to Central Park, you can walk anywhere you want. There's an urban continuity. In here, you have to get into a car or get into something that moves and get out of here.
That's The Curator, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time on Monocle 24. Brought to you in association with Rolex.
And welcome back to Midori House with me, Phil Hahn, and Dominic Reynolds. It is 8:17 here in London. Now, when Venezuelans headed to the polls last week, no one ever expected the results to be as close as it was. There was less than 2% separating Nicolas Maduro and opposition leader Enrique Capriles. The near 50-50 split has thrown the country into crisis. Nightly protests rock the streets of Caracas, and the future remains uncertain. Monocle's foreign editor Steve Bloomfield spoke to Reuters journalist Andrew Cawthorn for his analysis of what comes next.
It's been an extraordinary week in Venezuela after an extraordinary 6 months, in fact, since President Chavez's final bout with Chavez, and we've had two presidential elections, and Nicolas Maduro just squeaked through. The opposition defied all the pre-election polls and ran him incredibly close. Personally, I think that had the election been a couple of weeks or a month or two after, the opposition probably would have won. But Maduro squeaked through by about 265,000 votes, less than 2%. The opposition are not accepting the result, and it's still a very tense and volatile situation here in Venezuela.
Now, there's been lots of protests. As you say, the opposition are not accepting the result. It's likely, isn't it, that the result isn't really going to be overturned. The protest may well come to an end. But what happens next? Because he's, for all Chavez's faults, he was a charismatic figure that brought some supporters to him that perhaps his policies would, on their own, may not have. Maduro doesn't have that, does he?
No, he doesn't, Steve. I think you're right that the opposition protests probably aren't going anywhere. Most state here are tilted in favour of the government. The opposition would say they're packed with Chavista supporters, and it's rather unlikely the opposition are going to get anywhere now, although they will maintain their position of principle. So I think you're right. We're now looking at different issues and questions, and there are various. First of all, the economy is in a very delicate state at the moment. For decades, people have been sort of predicting crisis and collapse in Venezuela, which never quite happens because this is an OPEC member nation with the largest oil reserves in the world, and billions of dollars continue to pour in from the oil revenues. So Venezuela does have that stability, but this year it's once again going to have one of the highest inflation rates in the world. Economic growth is falling as government spending is slowing. There are actually a lot of shortages of products at the moment. People's purchasing power is going down a lot. So that's probably the main problem that Nicolas Maduro has on his plate. But also keeping together the coalition, the Socialist Party coalition, which around the mesmerizing and rather iron grip figure of Chavez, obviously it held together, but without that, it's looking a lot more delicate and fragile. On the opposition side, they have to stand back now and decide what they're going to do. They're looking at another 6 years in opposition. They got their best result ever. They don't agree with the result, but if they go out on the streets, probably more people are going to be injured or hurt or killed even. So a bit of a dilemma for them as well. Yeah, a lot of questions up in the air for the whole country at the moment.
And when we look at what Maduro might do, I mean, I guess in a sense it depends on which Maduro has become president. Is it the former foreign minister who's willing to compromise, has experience as a diplomat, might be willing to, you know, tweak the economy a little bit, might be willing to do some deals with the US, have a dialogue with the opposition? Or is it the former bus driver and union leader whose most important thing is going to be keeping his, as you say, his coalition together, which is at times quite fractious? I mean, which Maduro is it, do we think?
Well, you put your finger on it there. I mean, that's the million-dollar question, and no one has the answer yet, Steve. We're getting different signals. During the campaign, Maduro was trying to present himself as the son and the apostle, as he called it, of Chavez, and was repeating a lot of Chavez's very hard-line rhetoric. Then, of course, in the immediate aftermath of the vote, when tensions and were exacerbated and a lot of violence, he was also extremely hard-line, calling the opposition fascists and bourgeois and Yankee imperialists and so on. But perhaps that was a little bit born of necessity, firstly to present himself as Chavez's heir, and then secondly to face down the opposition and to consolidate his win. And maybe from now on, we'll start to see the true face of Nicolas Maduro emerging. Interestingly, last night, he replaced a very hard-line ideologue who was the finance minister with a more pragmatic and slightly more pro-free market figure who was the Nelson Morentes, the central bank president. So a lot of people are leaping on that, and the slightly more moderate tone in last night's speech announcing his cabinet as a sign that he might be a little more moderate going forward. He's certainly a very affable and chatty and friendly chap face-to-face and with journalists and so on, but it's a bit schizophrenic at the moment. He gave a speech to Parliament where he did say he was ready for dialogue, but at the same time he said, I'll speak to the devil if I have to, you know, and by devil he was referring to the opposition leader Enrique Capriles. So the whole country's waiting and watching on that question at the moment.
And then just finally and briefly on Enrique Capriles himself and the opposition. I mean, if Maduro has a job keeping together his coalition, so does Capriles. It's quite some coalition he has there. What's the next move, do you think, for the opposition?
Well, it's probably easier for him to keep the coalition together now than it was before the election, or than it would have been if he'd had a thrashing at the election, which a lot of people predicted. He's done better than any opposition leader here since Hugo Chavez came to power in 1999. He's clearly established himself as the undisputed opposition leader now. There's no one really who can test him. So I think the question for the opposition really is what should be their tactics going forward. I think the pre-election view that they might implode after the vote is probably not going to happen. I think it's just a very delicate tactical game now, with some in the opposition urging a hardline approach, street protests, and others urging a more pragmatic view, basically letting the economic and political problems, you know, thinking that they will probably cause sufficient damage to Maduro for there to be another possible opening for the opposition in local elections or in a recall referendum in a few years, something like that. But they're elated by their results, but very despondent having got so close and yet not won. It's a very tough moment for the Venezuelan opposition.
That was Reuters journalist Andrew Cawthorne. He was talking to Monocle's Steve Bloomfield.
Now, every day this week, we're featuring some of the stories that grace the pages of the new edition of Monocle magazine, which have hit the shelves of your local kiosks.
Now, today we turn our attention to the business pages of the magazine. Édition de la Revue Phénicienne is Lebanon's first French publisher, founded in 1920 by our Beirut correspondent's grandfather, no less. Well, our Beirut correspondent, Carol Corm, joins us on the line now to tell us about the heritage of the brand and how exactly she revived it. Welcome to Midori House, Carol. So tell us, how exactly did you come across this legacy of your grandfather, and how did you revive it?
Hi. Well, actually, it wasn't really me. It was my father and my uncle who revived it after the Lebanese War. It was something they had always wanted to do, and I helped them because it was something that interested me. We had this huge heritage. We had all these boxes. We had all these books, and we thought there was something to do with that.
So tell us about a bit about the history. This was first founded back in 1920 by your grandfather, Charles Corm. It was Lebanon's first French publisher. When you think of Lebanon and French publishing, they don't necessarily go hand in hand. So how did this all come about?
Well, historically, it's super interesting. This was a time when World War I had just ended. The French were about to come in and rule over Lebanon and Syria. And my grandfather came up with this, it was kind of a journal of thoughts and then more books, which were a platform for the thinkers of the time to kind of define the country they wanted now that it was being built. So economists, writers, poets kind of defined the Lebanon they wanted. So sure, they wrote in French because that was their culture. They were brought up in French-speaking schools, but it was a very Lebanese, very pro-Lebanon kind of publishing house and journal.
And I wonder, now that you have staged this revival, are you trying to keep that ethos going? Are you keeping that same type of publishing angle, progressive thinking about the direction of the nation?
Very much. I think it's almost ironic that the issues that my grandfather and the people who were writing in the 1920s are still the same issues today. Nothing has really changed and nothing has been really resolved. Lebanon still has serious identity problems. It doesn't know if it wants to go east or west. And what my grandfather and the people around him were proposing was a very humanistic approach, looking back at the Phoenicians, these trade people who brought the alphabet to the world. So it's a very friendly and cultural and cosmopolitan vision of the country and of publishing.
And Carol, you had the French aspect of the publishing house, but also you've just started your own English language editions as well.
Well, I mean, there's still quite a few people who speak French in Lebanon, but I mean, it is on the decline, and I'm more English educated, so I thought we would kind of add a little sister to the Revue Phénicienne, which would be in English, and which would kind of touch more of a Middle Eastern audience and not just Lebanese.
I wonder that the presentation in the publishing world, of course, has evolved wildly in that sort of 90-odd year period. How closely did you try and revive the look and feel of the previous items?
Well, the look and feel, the historic look and feel was sublime. It was beautiful. They really thought about things, and they used the best quality paper, the fonts. It was really very beautiful. So, I mean, we didn't want to change that too much, so we tried to use that as much as we can, and I think people appreciate that.
And how much do you find you're still channeling, I guess, the spirit of your grandfather? You know, there's this fascinating story in this issue of Monocle about how your grandfather was able to convince the soldiers during World War I to leave him the boxes of all the manuscripts and papers. So what, you know, that kind of spirit, is that still coursing through your veins?
Well, I guess so. I mean, history takes such a big part of the Lebanese in general. You know, we're news junkies. Our whole life is kind of dictated by the politics. So what my grandfather tried to do and what my father and uncle are doing, really, I mean, it's bringing a positive outlook on these things, trying to fight them, trying to understand them, trying to bring a bit of reason and beauty. So, yeah, and I grew up with this. I mean, I grew up with books all around me. I grew up with manuscripts and magazines and all these archives we had. So it's definitely my blood.
Carol, thanks so much for a nice personal story this morning on Midori House. That's Monocle's Beirut correspondent, Carol Korm.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
In the next half hour of the programme, we'll be flicking through the Australian papers with Monocle's Adrian Craddock, and we'll hear from Helen de Brule of Hermès Maison.
Here with this collection, every object answers the needs for day-to-day life and brings something else. So you have objects that will accompany the day-to-day life in the home.
So a very busy second half of the program, but before all that, here is Barney Burnham with the latest news.
Thanks, Phil. The French embassy in Tripoli has been hit by a suspected car bombing. Two guards were injured. France's Foreign Minister Laurent Fabius has condemned the attack as heinous. The surviving suspect in the Boston Marathon bombing has been formally charged with conspiring to use weapons of mass destruction in the attack in which three people were killed. If convicted, Dzhokhar Tsarnaev could face the death penalty. Two men will appear in court today, charged with plotting a major terrorist attack in Canada. They're accused of planning to bomb passenger trains linking Toronto with New York City. Canadian authorities have described it as an Al-Qaeda-inspired plot and claim the pair had support from Iran. The US Secretary of State has said the vast majority of Muslims around the world oppose violence. John Kerry is calling for a continued dialogue with moderate groups, saying it's the only way to stop extremists dominating debate. And scientists in the UK say they've created a strain of bacteria which can produce fuel. Researchers at Exeter University genetically modified E. coli bacteria to convert sugar into an oil that's almost identical to conventional diesel. There's the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Barney. We'll see you back at the top of the hour with another check of the world headlines. You're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Phil Hahn, and Dominic Reynolds. Now, this week on Section D, Hugo MacDonald will bring you a range of reports from the 52nd annual Salone di Mobile Furniture Fair in Milan. Among other delights, Hugo will meet architects who make cutlery and a Japanese brand who've created a new design range for dogs.
In this preview, that sounds extraordinary, a new design range for dogs. It caught me by surprise, but in this preview, we meet Hélène de Brule, Director General of Hermès Maison. In 2011, Hermès entered the home market with an exquisitely crafted collection of furniture, fabrics and wallpapers. And last year at Salone, the fashion house pushed the conceptual boat out a little further, launching a modular system of architectural elements by Japanese architect Shigeru Ban. Section D's producer Ali John met Hélène to find out more.
We presenting here three new novelties. The first, a new collection of furniture, which is called Les Nécessaires d'Hermès. It's a line that really plays with functionality and objects that will bring a supplement of usage with all the comforts, the discreet and sober elegance of Hermès, and with the highest quality of materials and of expertise. And then we're also presenting a new story of furnishing fabrics and wallpaper. And at the end, we wanted also to highlight this year our expertise in made-to-measure bespoke pieces to answer the dreams of our clients or their architects, dreams in terms of interior architecture. And we're presenting two pieces which are like an exercise of style, a 7-meter wardrobe and a buffet, tableware buffet. And they are really extraordinary in terms of dimensions and savoir-faire.
You mentioned there that Hermès is trying to tell a story, a new story with this collection. Could you outline exactly what that story is?
With Le Nécessaire d'Hermès, we have this reflection on the sense of the object at Hermès. Hermès is creating objects from 1837, started with harnesses, saddles, accessories. Each time, for each object, there's a story about functionality, comfort, and elegance, style in movement. Here with this collection, every object answers the needs for day-to-day life and brings something else. So you have multifunctional objects, very astute and ingenious objects that will accompany the day-to-day life in the home.
Focusing then on the new collection, what are some of the key items you see that characterize that kind of feel for what's being unveiled at this year's Salone del Mobile?
Here we have, designed by Philippe Nigro, carré d'assises. These are some seats that are inspired from our silk scarf, that is this 90 by 90 iconic product. And Philippe Nigro designed a seat which also can be a table, a side table. And you can play with three different heights of these seats in order to modulate a new way of sitting. You also have an incredible home valet, which we have called the groom, which really is the perfect object for dressing up yourself in the morning or in the evening. And you every object finds its own space. It's an articulate, very mobile, the perfect home valet. And there's also what we call the coffre à lutrin. It's like a workstation, mobile workstation, where you can have your magazines, your iPad, your cup of coffee, your tea, and it is mobile. And it is, all of these objects are really made with the best of the best materials, very noble, leather of course, but also walnut, noyer canalito walnut, stainless steel, with the expertise of the best leather craftsmen, but also the best cabinet makers, tapestries. This is also where Hermès is giving something else with a definitely highest quality possible.
What distinguishes Hermès Maison from some of the competitors who have also branched into interiors?
Quality. Really, the idea that when you buy an Hermes bag, you know that you will have the noblest materials, which will have been worked by craftsmen with traditional technique and incredible expertise. Our ambition is to do the same in the world of interiors, and this is really how we differentiate, and also the idea of our style, of course, which has to be discreet, really sober, with this in all its elegant simplicity.
Hélène, you began in Hermès in 2002, and then in 2009 you took over the Hermès Maison division. What goals did you have when you began in your role as a general manager of Hermès Maison?
First of all, to express the unicity of Hermès in this world of the home was the key challenge, and to define the right strategy in order to be ourselves and to be different from the environment. These are the key challenges, and of course to find the best experts in this field. Experts in terms of people who are working, designers, suppliers, and because expertise is something that is required when you want to provide the best quality possible.
Hélène de Brule there. She was speaking to Monocle producer Alad John. And you can hear more stories on design on this week's edition of Section D, which premieres tonight at 1900 hours London time.
I think I'm just excited to hear about this design range for dogs.
The design range for dogs
piqued my interest.
That was and it wasn't in that preview, but I'm intrigued.
What do you think it is?
I guess
like clothing, because that's been done, isn't it?
Like a range of shoes. I haven't seen dog shoes before.
I've seen shoes. They have booties.
What about proper leather like brogues? Like
those could be nice.
Brogue for dogs.
But they're not very waterproof, are they?
Well, I mean, I don't...
Well, I was thinking maybe modular
really
housing.
Dogs
who
normally don't wear shoes aren't going to worry if their new shoes are waterproof or not.
Yeah, but the owner's not going to want to buy brogues that...
I think we need to brainstorm this one off air.
Well, you are listening to Midori House with me, Dominic Reynolds. No, with me, Phil
Hunt. Gone wrong.
And Dominic Reynolds. I've got a dog on my mind. We'll be back right after this with a check-in from our man in Madrid.
A 10-minute drive from downtown Hong Kong is an industrial estate that has evolved into a neighborhood. Monocle Films goes inside its warehouse towers to discover artists, designers, and retailers, creating a community.
At the moment, we are making it the place that we would like it to be by bringing the people that we think are adding value to the area.
A cinematic portrait of Chai Wan, Hong Kong's industrial wasteland turned good. Now playing in the Films menu on Monocle.com.
Every weekend here on Monocle 24, we like to take a break from the rigours of our hard-hitting news agenda and have a leisurely look at the arts.
Anything can be made interesting by looking at something long enough or from the right angle.
Starting at 8 a.m. London time on Saturdays, the weekend edition brings you a mix of music, news, and very special guests with me, Georgina Godwin.
I discovered that I was enjoying listening to it as a piece of music, not just as an installation in that gallery. I thought, this sounds like a new album.
I'll be talking to a variety of talent from the worlds of literature, music, theatre and television, as well as introducing you to new selections from our global playlist.
It's something entrenched and strange, and it's a mysterious relationship with your own creativity, and it's a lifelong negotiation.
That's the weekend edition, Saturday from 8 a.m. and Sundays from 16 to 1800 hours, London time, right here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back. You're listening to Midori House with me, Phil Hahn.
Oh, that's better.
And Dominic.
How was it being Dominic Reynolds, briefly? Did you enjoy it?
I'm glad I'm Phil again. Let's
really?
Put it that way. Yeah, I think it's for
well,
the best.
Well, you didn't give it enough time.
I think 1 second is enough.
You've got to settle. Unbelievable.
1 second's enough. The time here in London is 8:42. It is 9:42 in Madrid.
And that is where we're headed now to see what's making the headlines. Monocle's Liam Aldous is there. Liam, good morning. How are you?
I'm great, and I'm Liam Aldous, just to make that clear.
Excellent. Do you know what? You can stay, Liam Aldous. That's fine. Phil might try and steal your identity before the end of this interview, though. Don't worry. Let's talk about another queen of the divas, Isabel Pantoja. She's been found guilty in a money laundering case.
Yeah, she's fallen from grace, finally. It's been a long court case, but she's been found guilty of money laundering and bribery. She was actually mixed up with her ex-boyfriend at the time, who was the mayor of Marbella, Julian Muñoz. And they had a huge money racketing scheme going on, and she's been found guilty. They've all been found guilty, and she's been charged, actually given a sentence of 2 years. But don't fear, the internationally renowned copla singer won't be going to jail because it's her first offence, so she's just going to have to pay a 1.14 million euro fine.
And for those of us that aren't familiar with her work, give us a sense of who exactly she is.
Well, maybe I could just say she's probably Spain's version of Celine Dion. So I mean, she's the diva of Spain, and everyone loves her. Actually, when I was watching the trial on TV, you'd see people outside. She's being charged with stealing public money, and there's people outside saying, we love you, and with big bunches of flowers. And then suddenly when she was actually found guilty, there's suddenly people heckling her. I don't know what they thought was going on for the last 5 years during the trial, but
well, I suppose
she was actually heckled and swamped, and she fell to the ground. It was very dramatic. She was actually dramatic the whole time through the trial. She was wearing sunglasses in the courtroom. Every time she made a statement, she would just say, oh, thank you very much, everyone. it was quite absurd and quite ridiculous, but yeah, she's been found guilty, so justice has prevailed.
Well, I suppose it's an interesting kind of focal point, because all over Europe and in Spain and in Germany, we were talking about earlier, they're trying to cut down on people sort of getting through loopholes and not paying their due, and getting money into places where it shouldn't be. But at the same time, she's clearly a very popular figure, so a bit of a conflict there for the Spanish.
Yeah, a big conflict. I think she was kind of a victim of maybe the relationship she was in, because her ex-boyfriend was the mayor of Marbella. He came up the ranks as a waiter. He was actually a waiter and became the mayor, and as soon as he got the power, it seems he wanted all the money. And his ex-wife as well has also been implicated. She was actually given a 3-year sentence, so everyone this man touched seemed to seem to get into trouble. So we'll see if there's any more developments, because he's got another trial coming up in the next few weeks, and he may actually be getting a sentence of 13 years. So we'll see what happens there.
And Liam, just moving on to another story that's caught your eye. Housing evictions has been a hot topic there in Spain. The government approving some draft legislation for housing evictions, though.
Yeah, finally they've approved the draft legislation, but it was watered down so much. This was actually last Thursday. It was watered down so much that the PAH, which is the platform for the mortgages, the movement, which has actually been targeting politicians with escraches, which is a big protest at the houses of the politicians, they actually withdrew their support because it was watered down so much, and every single party actually didn't support the legislation except the government. And I was actually, I live near the parliament, and on Thursday there was such high security when this legislation was going through. It just, the whole parliament turned into a fortress. There were police everywhere. But they've actually said that the PAH has actually said they're withdrawing their support and they're not happy, and they've been targeting more politicians with escraches. But you've seen the government actually up the ante with the rhetoric against these kinds of, these forms of protests, calling, you had the Secretary General of the party calling them a new form of Nazism, saying that it's extremism. They've actually threatened to now fine people actually in these escraches €6,000 each if they're actually participating in these escraches. It's actually it's getting quite tense, but the government is staying put and staying firm and not willing to change.
Presumably, not great things might happen if these already quite angry protesters are having their entire method of protest clamped down on.
Yeah, it's going to get probably worse, because these people, you have to remember, are the victims of evictions. They're actually the people who have suffered the most. So actually fining them an extra €6,000 isn't probably the solution. But you've also seen the police come out yesterday and saying they're no longer going to call them escraches. They're just going to call it abuse or assault or a form of intimidation. So they're actually altering their language to really to clamp down on this form of protest.
And Liam, you, of course, were born and raised in Australia, and you are, though, living in Spain now. But it looks like some other people haven't had as much luck as you, and many expats are actually leaving Spain.
Yeah, they're all leaving. I have to publicly state that I'm staying. I'm not going anywhere, so there are no designs on my job over here. But in 2011, and about 16,000 expats left Spain, but then last year in 2012, 205,000 foreigners left Spain. And this is the first time it's actually fallen so sharply in 16 years since records began of foreigners living in Spain, which is actually interesting. They only started the record 16 years ago, how many foreigners were living here. But a lot of people are leaving Spain because it doesn't seem like the crisis is getting any better. So a lot of these people are from South America, and they're going back to South America to greener pastures where the economy is actually booming.
Monocle's man in Madrid, Liam Aldous, thank you very much. And now we will be leafing through, that's right, the Australian front page. It's quite an Antipodean-sounding second half of today's show. Monocle's resident Aussie Adrian Craddock will be with us shortly. But taking us there is Perth's Randa and the Soul Kingdom with Lovesick. From Perth, that was Randa and the Soul Kingdom with Lovesick.
Are you lovesick?
No.
No, you're about to get married, so you're not lovesick.
Well, I mean...
Well, I don't know.
I don't know what sort of sick you are over the weekend.
Let's keep it cordial.
Yeah.
It's time now to go through some of the front pages. And today we turn our attentions to the Australian press with Monocle's resident Australian, Adrian Craddock. Hello, Adrian. How are you?
Hi, guys.
Hello.
How are you going?
Good. How are you?
Yeah.
You've got a couple of the Australian papers, The Age, The Australian, and The Sydney Morning Herald. Which one do you want to start off with today?
Well, I think across the board, there seems to be one story that's coming through, I think quite surprisingly strong. I didn't really think it was as big of a deal as the Australian press has made it out to be, but Chrissy Amphlett, who's the front woman of the band The Divinals, she passed away sadly today, and it's everywhere. Like, one of my favourite things, sorry, I don't mean to be insensitive, but The Age... quite strangely, because the Divine was the big song. As
know the big song.
I touch myself. That's their big song.
can we put what you just did on the playlist?
Absolutely. No, and one of the subtitles on The Age is Chrissy Amphlett, 1959 to 2013. She touched others too.
Which, that is a strange sub-editing choice, isn't it?
I know. I guess it is kind of nice to be kind of lighthearted about it. Because she is quite a big deal in Australia.
But yeah. She did die very young at the age of 53. She battled breast cancer and multiple sclerosis. So
quite sad.
Very sad news.
So we bid farewell to Chrissy Amphlett this morning. Quite sad.
But clearly, the Divinals, as far as I'm concerned, I guess a bit of a one-hit wonder. Clearly not one-hit wonders, though, from one of their fellow Australians.
But for an Australian, maybe it's one hit is enough. No offense.
Well, you know, we do what we can. So if we have that one hit, we really hang on to it. So the other story that struck me was a story on the front page of The Australian. And the photo on the front page of The Australian is an Indigenous couple standing in the middle of a red dust desert with a tree next to them, which is littered with beer bottles and beer cans at the base of it. And the line there is, people are just drinking themselves to death. And it's one of those funny ones with The Australian Press, how they report on Indigenous issues. If you read the actual copy, nowhere does it actually say that this is an Indigenous issue. It's just that photo to suggest that.
I see, that's the link.
Yeah. Right. So it's always a thing that the Australian Press is very, well, sometimes sensitive with, sometimes they're quite brash about it. But when you read through, the story is about how a lot of these communities, again, just the word communities is used, not Indigenous communities, are spending 100% of their welfare benefits on drink. I don't know what to make of that. I mean, another example, I guess, of, you know, you don't really ever see any good news stories about the Indigenous population in Australia. And I think that the interesting thing is here that when you read through, a lot is talked about how, you know, the government has invested so much in alcohol abuse programs, and why aren't these people improving themselves? But there's no column space devoted to preventative measures. There's nothing. Mm-hmm. There's no kind of discussion about, integrating Indigenous communities into our population, and
so this is something that as an Australian you feel like the dialogue, the national dialogue, isn't being pushed by media outlets in the way that it should be on issues like this.
Definitely. I think that the main thing is here, it seems to always be a discussion that happens after the fact. You know, why aren't these people going to alcohol abuse programs and so forth, and you know, why are they spending their money on booze? Nothing to do with, you know, how have we got to this point as a nation, and how as a nation, rather than these people specifically, how as a nation can we move forward and fix this?
Because there are plenty of non-Indigenous communities that have major drinking problems in Australia as well.
Exactly,
I believe.
Exactly, and I don't know. It's just a bit of a funny one. Maybe that's just me being a pinko lefty.
It was about 4 years ago then when then Prime Minister Kevin Rudd did apologise publicly for the lost generation of the Indigenous communities of Australia. Do you think that this is still an issue that resonates with people in big cities like Melbourne, Sydney, Perth, or is this an issue that has kind of went to the back burner, so to speak?
I definitely think that the apology was a really big deal when it happened, but at the end of the day, they are still words, and I think there still is a very tangible divide in Australia still, especially in these remote communities, as far as integrating Indigenous people into the mainstream Australian culture. Anyway, but if you look up as well, there's an interesting story about Labor going through some of their budget before the election. And there's it's just interesting to read the contrast compared to other countries that are going through their budgets at the moment.
So this is the top of the Australian as well.
Yeah, Labor sounds budget alarm. And looking here, there's a quote here from Gillard, and it says, "Cutting and cutting and cutting wouldn't help our economy stay strong. It would hurt people." And it's just interesting when you look at Europe and austerity across the board, Gillard's taken, a very different stance. And it's just, it's interesting to kind of observe it when we're one of the, you know, our economy is one of the best in the developed world. So it's interesting to see that. But of course, kind of unsurprisingly, The Australian, which is a very liberal paper, takes a very sceptical view on that.
And just very quickly, Adrian, onto the Sydney Morning Herald. It's coming up to Anzac Day on Thursday. There's a story on the front page about the Libs reigniting a cultural war.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because one of the big things that's resonated throughout the Liberal Party is pushing British history back into our curriculums, because John Howard 2 years ago he made this comment about how Indigenous history, well, not so much Indigenous history has overtaken British history, but more that British history needs to be made a kind of a bigger deal of in our curriculum, which, you know, is a kind of arguable thing to say. But Anzac Day coming up, and the big thing was, you know, we can't dwell too much on the negative parts of our history, you know, obviously very, very sad World War One, but the big push is to kind of focus more on the positive parts of Australian history.
Monocle's Adrian Craddock, thanks very much. Dawn Trump was our producer today. That's all we've got time for. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London,
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo,
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Essa é a Monocle 24.
From London.
In London.
London, cara.
De Londres.
Esto es Monocle 24.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives: that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.